Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we continue the struggle against censorship, past and present. We'll be talking about the untold history of the United States, the series and book by Oliver Stone and Professor Peter Kuznick. We'll hear excerpts from Kuznick, Stone, and Daniel Ellsberg from a special Project Censored event that was done in February 2013 at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we examine the untold history of the United States, the book and series, Showtime series, also DVD, Warner Brothers DVDs and Blu-ray. The DVD will be out March 4. This Untold History of the United States by Oliver Stone and Professor Peter Kuznick of American University is really quintessential reading and viewing for people in the present that want to understand our past and also do something about it and use it to act intelligently in the present and as a map for where we're going into the future. So from the foreword of Untold History, Kuznick and Stone state, this book and documentary film series is based on challenge the basic narrative of U.S. history that most Americans have been taught. That popular and somewhat mythic view carefully filtered through the prism of American altruism, benevolence, magnanimity, exceptionalism, and devotion to liberty and justice is introduced in early childhood, reinforced throughout primary and secondary education, and retold so often that it becomes part of the air that Americans breathe. It is consoling, it is comforting, but it only tells a small part of the story. It may convince those who don't probe too deeply, but like the real air Americans breathe, it is ultimately harmful, noxious, polluted. It not only renders Americans incapable of understanding the way much of the rest of the world looks at the United States, it leaves them unable to act effectively to change the world for the better. For Americans, like people everywhere, are enthralled to their visions of the past, rarely realizing the extent to which their understanding of history shapes behavior in the here and now. Historical understanding defines people's very sense of what is thinkable and achievable. As a result, many have lost the ability to imagine a world that is substantially different from and better than what exists today. The Untold History of the United States series and book are significant contributions to our understanding of the past. And I'd like to point out that the book, the companion book to the series, is actually different. It goes into much more detail. The authors, Stone and Kuznick, state, "We see the book and documentary as complementary but not the same. We hope documentary viewers will read the book to get a fuller sense of this history, and that readers will watch the documentary to get the full power of the visual and dramatic presentation." Stone and Kuznick offer both book and film series to the forces of progressive change around the world in the hopes that the information we provide will prove useful in their fight for a more just, humane, democratic, and equitable world. Peter, tell us a little bit more about what's in the Untold History of the United States.
American leaders often believe they are unbound by history, yet Stone and Kuznick argue that we must face our troubling history honestly and forthrightly in order to set a new course for the 21st century. They trace the American empire in the Untold History of the United States, both in the book and the series, through the bloody U.S. suppression of the Filipino struggle for independence, the establishment of U.S. financial hegemony in the world after World War I, repeated U.S. interventions, covert operations and wars in Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East, and the transformation of America into a prying national security state and the accumulation of vast fortunes by the wealthiest Americans and troubling assaults on U.S. constitutional liberties. So they trace it all the way from the Spanish-American War up to the present, to the Obama administration, a lot of attention to the Bush administration. This is a history that all people in this country can have and need to know about what's the kinds of repressive forces that are happening historically in our country, and to really have a full recognition of who we are as an American people.
That's right, Peter. And the Untold History of the United States book and film series is available for people to use as a great tool, a conversation starter. And last February, we had the honor of hosting Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, along with historic whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. We had a wonderful evening, a dialogue, a discussion. We screened one of the parts of the series that's also a chapter in the book on The Bomb, The Tragedy of a Small Man. Now, in the book, this is chapter 4, and it examines whether or not the United States actually needed to drop the atomic bomb on Japan. And the chapter begins citing historian Paul Fussell, who was about to be transferred from Europe to the Pacific when he received the news of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And in 1988, Fussell published Thank God for the Atom Bomb. Quote, "For all the fake manliness of our facades, we cried with relief and joy. We were going to live. We were going to grow up to adulthood after all." Stone and Kuznick write, "Generations of Americans have been taught that the U.S. reluctantly dropped atomic bombs on Japan at the end of World War II to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of young men like Fussell who were poised to die if the U.S. invaded." They go on to state, "But the story is really more complicated and much more disturbing." Well, the evening we spent with Stone and Kuznick and Ellsberg, they talked about this issue, and they talked about many more things. Here is a clip of Peter Kuznick talking about the film series and specifically the episode on The Bomb. He's going to be talking a little bit about an otherwise now obscured character in American history, and he's going to tell the untold story of Henry Wallace. Here is Professor Peter Kuznick.
Well, thank you all for coming out tonight, and especially thanks to Mickey Huff, who made this all possible. Mickey has been indefatigable in making things work. One of the things we're doing with this project is we're trying to debunk certain fundamental myths. What we're doing is a history of the American empire and national security state from the late 19th century all the way up to the second Obama administration. And one of the big myths that we go after in the first episode is the question of who won the war in Europe. Most Americans, if you ask them, say, of course, the United States was the dominant force in winning the war in Europe, which is part of American mythology. The reality was that it was the Soviet Union who won the war in Europe, that throughout most of the war, the United States and the British were facing 10 German divisions combined, while the Soviets were facing over 200 German divisions. As Churchill says, it was the Soviet army that tore the guts out of the Nazis. The Americans lost about 305,000 in combat during World War II. The Soviets lost a total throughout the war of 27 million. So this is part of that history that needs to be known because it's essential in setting up the Cold War. Our second episode talks about the Cold War. One of the key things, the key demands that the Soviets were making when the war started, after they were attacked by the Germans, was for the United States and the British to open up a second front in Europe to take some of that pressure off them since they were facing such a heavy German military presence. The United States, in June of 1942, Roosevelt and Marshall promised publicly that we would open up the second front in Europe by the end of 1942, largely because of Churchill. We don't open up the second front until June of 1944. By that point, the tide has changed militarily. So we talk about that in episode 2. But episode 3 that we're showing tonight is really about the atomic bombing, the decision to drop the bomb, and the legacy of the nuclear arms race. What I want to do to set this up is tell you about one key person who we introduce episodes 1 and 2 who you might not know a lot about, somebody who we think is a visionary, a hero, who's been lost to history in the United States, and that's Henry Wallace. When I asked my student who is Roosevelt's vice president from 1941 to 1945, they usually draw a blank. They don't know about Henry Wallace. Wallace comes from a distinguished farm family from Iowa. His father was Secretary of Agriculture. Roosevelt asked Wallace to be his Secretary of Agriculture in the first two New Deal administrations. And then in 1940, Roosevelt knew we were heading for a war against fascism and Japanese militarism, and he wanted a leading anti-fascist on the ticket as vice president, and he asked Wallace to run as his vice presidential running mate. The party bosses didn't like that. Wallace was too radical, and they refused to put Wallace on the ticket. Roosevelt wrote an extraordinary letter to the Democratic Convention in 1940 saying that we already have one money-dominated, Wall Street-dominated conservative party in the United States, the Republican Party. He said if the Democratic Party isn't a party that believes in social justice and progressive ideals, it has no reason to exist, and I'm turning down the nomination. I'm not going to run as a presidential candidate in such a party. He was serious. He drafted a letter. Eleanor Roosevelt went to the convention the first time a first lady ever did and made it clear that they understood that that he was serious, and they put Wallace on the ticket. As vice president, he was again extraordinary. In 1941, Henry Luce, the head of the Time Life Empire, writes his famous editorial saying the 20th century must be the American century. The United States should dominate the world in every way. Wallace countered that as vice president, and he said the 20th century must be the century of the common man. He called for a worldwide people's revolution in the tradition of the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Latin American Revolutions, and the Russian Revolution. He said we've got to end colonialism, imperialism, economic exploitation. We've got to spread the fruits of science and industry around the world. We've got to raise standards of living. He called for ending monopolies and cartels. He subsequently said that America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the nation comes second. Nowadays, we call them Democrats or Republicans, but Wallace understood what they represented in 1942. So in 1944, the party bosses decided they wanted to get Wallace off the ticket. Edwin Pauley, the Democratic Party treasurer, led the campaign. He called it Pauley's coup. Pauley was a California oil millionaire who said, I went into politics when I realized it was cheaper to elect a new Congress than to buy up the old one. He later gets indicted appropriately, but now he leads this attempt to get Wallace off the ticket and to replace him with Harry Truman. At the night of the Democratic Convention started, July 20th, 1944, Gallup released a poll of potential Democratic voters asking who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% said they wanted Wallace. Wallace is the second most popular man in the country. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. But the party bosses had fixed the convention in ways that they can't even do nowadays. And so they had it engineered for Truman. Wallace made the seconding speech for Roosevelt the first night. The place went wild, a spontaneous demonstration for almost an hour led by Hubert Humphrey and Adlai Stevenson. And in the midst of that, Senator Claude Pepper from Florida knew that if he could get to the microphone and get Wallace's name and nomination, Wallace would sweep the convention, defy the bosses, be back on the ticket as vice president. Pepper got within 5 feet of the microphone. At that point, the party boss was screaming, adjourn this session. Sam Jackson, who was chairing, didn't know what to do. He said, I have a motion to adjourn. All in favor, say aye. Almost nobody says aye. All opposed, say no. Everybody booms out no. And he says, motion carried, meeting adjourned. Pepper was literally 5 feet from the microphone. If he had gotten 5 more feet and got Wallace's name and nomination, Wallace would have been back on the ticket as vice president. When Roosevelt died on April 12, 45, Wallace would have become president of the United States. What we're arguing here is that had Wallace been president instead of Truman, there would not only have been no atomic bombing in 1945, there might very well have been no Cold War. History would have been fundamentally different. And that's one of the themes we're trying to show, how close we've come to having a very different outcomes. That the history we have was not inevitable. And the history that we're going to have in the future is not inevitable. People can change history, and we've come very close a number of times in the past that most Americans don't understand. So that's another one of our themes that we develop throughout this series.
That was Professor Peter Kuznick. That was from an event Project Censored sponsored in February of 2013, The Untold History of the United States. Peter, tell us what this series and this book get into in some more detail.
Well, the book, The Untold History of the United States, has been out for almost a year. The movies played on Showtime and are now coming out at a DVD on March 4th, but are also available on Blu-ray, I believe, now. So this whole history was researched meticulously over a year by a team of graduate students at American University. So they really put some serious time documenting the veracity of all the material in this series and in this book. It's extremely important. And, of course, the authors reveal that the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were militarily unnecessary and morally indefensive. They also recognize the United States. It was not the Soviet Union. It was the U.S. that bore the lion's share of responsibility for the perpetuation of the Cold War. The U.S. love affair with right-wing dictators has gone far as overthrowing elected leaders, arming and training murderous military officers, and forcing millions of people into poverty. And the U.S. funded Islamic fundamentalists who fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan have blown back to threaten the interests of the United States and its allies. These are all very important issues, and it describes meticulously how U.S. presidents, especially in wartime, have frequently trampled on the Constitution and international law, and we're seeing that continued under the Bush and the Obama administration. And the United States has been the primary country in the world to banish nuclear threats repeatedly and terrifying others and coming close to nuclear war. These are all very important subjects for Americans to know in terms of our history and part of that series.
That's right, Peter. And as a professor of history, I really welcome this revised narrative, the challenging of the official narrative. It's a great text that I've been using in class with students to introduce them to a lot of this material. Of course, the video series is useful as well. We know that more and more Americans aren't reading books, which is certainly a sad commentary, but they can still get access to this history, and maybe seeing the series will charge them up about history. And The Untold History is an exhaustive volume, really, in this way. It obviously doesn't cover everything. No volume can, but we're talking about a 750-page book here, researched by American University students with Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone, and it begins with the late 19th, early 20th century, and really looks at the untold history of American empire, and it goes all the way up through the Bush years and the Obama years. So it comes pretty close up to the present, challenging these narratives. So it's really, I think, an important note here to show folks that this takes a real hard look at America in the 20th century and where we're heading in the 21st century. From the beginnings of the book, it talks about General Smedley Butler, right? We're talking about the second most decorated Marine in U.S. history, who in 1935, after leaving the Marine Corps, wrote a book called War is a Racket. And Smedley Butler stated, quote, "I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general, and during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism." That's how the book really begins here with the introduction, by talking about the underside of corporate capitalism and how it fuels American foreign policy. And that's certainly been a theme that has fueled American foreign policy up through to the present. Now, we have another clip here to share from the evening we spent with Stone and Kuznick and Daniel Ellsberg. And they had a wonderful conversation and back and forth, talking specifically about the episode of the series and the chapter in the book on the bomb, on the decision to drop the bomb, the morality of it, the ethics of it. But also, they really go back and look at the facts of the matter and challenge this official narrative that the United States had no choice and the bomb was used to save lives. Of course, that narrative is regurgitated in Vietnam when we talk about having to destroy the villages in order to save the people. It's very Orwellian doublespeak here. But here is Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, and Daniel Ellsberg talking about this. And Daniel Ellsberg was young at the time. He was alive in World War II, and he talks about his experiences.
I'm the person with this panel who was alive when the bomb was dropped and who has a clear-cut, vivid memory of that, which actually was something that didn't surprise me in the way that it did nearly every other American. As you saw in the film, the Americans had been led to believe that there was no chance that the Japanese would surrender. They were fighting suicidally in Okinawa and elsewhere. They showed the American public knew nothing of the intercepted communications that we were getting there, showing that the emperor was ready to surrender, basically, on if unconditional surrender were dropped and the emperor himself, the imperial institution, would remain. The American public had no clue of that. But as Peter and Oliver have shown very well, in fact, the people in the top of the government knew that there was very little need, probably, for an invasion at that point, and that they had other alternatives. An odd thing was that in 1944, I was in the ninth grade, I guess, in school in Michigan, Cranbrook School, and we had a social science teacher who was relatively left-wing for the school that I was in, and had assigned us a essay project one day, which was, he said, there is a possibility of a U-235 bomb. Now, this was during the war. Manhattan Project was our biggest secret. In fact, it was the really beginning, in a way, of secrecy system for civilians in the country outside the military. And there had, however, been a couple of stories during the war about the possibility of uranium bomb that actually were thought to be great leaks by the FBI and were highly investigated, it turned out, but in actually simply reflected the information from 1938 and 1939 that fission had been achieved, and there were speculations on this stuff. So he had just read an article on this, and he said, here is a bomb that would be 1,000 times more powerful than our largest blockbuster, which was a good estimate. Our largest blockbuster then was about a 10-ton bomb. They had a few 12- and 20-ton bombs, a handful, but basically a 10-ton bomb. It was called a blockbuster because it destroyed essentially a city block. Most bombs were much smaller than that. So if that had been 10 kilotons, that would be exactly 1,000 times the blockbuster. So here, the question was, how would humanity deal with this? Would it be a good thing for humanity or not? This was in late 44. Now, I think that we had a week to do an essay on that. And I think that every member of that class, and we were then 13, 14, you didn't have to be, as they now say, a rocket scientist, to realize humanity is not a species that can handle this. It's too much. This will not be a good thing. And the essence wasn't on who would control it. Would it be the Germans, who had discovered the fission, actually, under Nazi Germany? Or would it be us? But quite apart from that, whoever discovered it, would this bode well for humanity? And as I say, all of us 13-year-olds, as best I can remember, said, bad. This would not be a good thing. And patriotic as we were and following the newsreels. On August 6th, I can very vividly remember, I was standing in Detroit, my hometown, August 6th, very hot day. The streetcar was clattering past. As I read a headline, a single bomb has destroyed this Japanese city, described as a military base by Truman. The first statement about the bomb being a lie by the president. And I looked at that headline and I thought, I know exactly what that is. That's the bomb we were studying last fall. And I had a very great feeling, an ominous feeling, when I heard Truman on the radio actually saying, the greatest scientific achievement in history, and we've done this, so we've unlocked the power of the sun and so forth. It seemed to me already from those 6 months earlier that there should be more anguish, more anxiety, and a tragic feeling in what I was hearing. And I felt worried about that. And the point I want to make here is simply this. You didn't have to be any kind of genius or especially wise or anything else to see that. Learning about it as we did in the fall of 44, before it was introduced to the public in the guise of a savior, a war winner, there couldn't have been a way of introducing that bomb to the world, and to, I should say, to Americans above all, to Americans, more deadly in its way, more legitimating of the use of that bomb. Imagine if Hitler, for example, had used it, had had one or two bombs, which is all we had, and used it on London or Birmingham, and something wiped out a city. The very design of the bomb would have been the first charge at Nuremberg for which scientists would have been hanged. It would have been stigmatized as a Nazi concept, Only the Nazis could do such a thing. How things would have gone, it would not have won the war. It absolutely would not have changed the end of the war. The effect being then that it would be, we'd recognize it's something that to be punished, to be regarded, to be done. But as it was, and here is where I so much admire what you and what Oliver and Peter have done here in bringing this to the American public. It's not a story that's untold to historians. They know that. But the public at large, how many people really knew, even in this select audience, the concepts that were presented there. The result was that there were really no qualms about going into an American-led atomic and then thermonuclear arms race to expand our use of this weapon that had been such a savior of American lives. And so say, if you had considered it, I think almost anybody considering it 6 months earlier as a concept would have recognized it as what it is. Basically, Nazi concept of massacre as a form of waging war.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, Uncensoring Our Own History, we're looking more specifically at the untold history of the United States. The book and DVD companion, the Blu-ray is already out. The DVD will be out March 4th. The book is out in paperback, Untold History of the United States. We're listening to clips from an event Project Censored sponsored last February in 2013 called The Untold History of the United States. And we had a wonderful evening of discussion with Peter Kuznick, Oliver Stone, and Daniel Ellsberg. And they were talking about the importance of understanding our past so that we can act more meaningfully in the present. The evening of sharing the untold history of the United States included discussion and questions and answers from the audience. Here are some highlights from that dialogue.
The other huge myth of World War II was the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. Some historians say that FDR knew about it, in fact had provoked it through withholding petroleum supplies, and that they had broken the code. What is your understanding?
We didn't take that issue on. My understanding is that Roosevelt told Churchill that we were going to act in order to get into the war. We were going to conduct ourselves as if we're at war. He welcomed getting into the war. The public, as you know, was not in favor of getting into the war in Europe. And that's largely because World War I had been such a nightmare. So there was very strong anti-war sentiment throughout the country. Even though most Americans strongly supported the British side in the war, they didn't want to get involved militarily. So Roosevelt knew he would have to maneuver the United States into the war. We knew that an attack was imminent. I'm not convinced yet that we knew that the attack was coming at Pearl Harbor, but we knew that the Japanese, we'd cut off a lot of their oil supplies. We knew that they needed access to that oil. We cut off a lot of their raw material supplies. So we were maneuvering to get into the war. Roosevelt wanted to get the United States into the war. Most people were shocked that it was the Japanese who triggered it and not the Germans. We expected to be in a war with Germany, actually, before we got into the war with Japan. So we don't go into the question of whether this was a conspiracy on Roosevelt's part, that he absolutely knew that Pearl Harbor was coming. But we know that he was positioning us to get into that war, and he strongly wanted us in that war.
My question is for Oliver Stone. There seems to be a common thread, not just between World War II and every war that we fought, and that is the role of international financiers. Germany, for example, was broke after World War I. All of a sudden, 15 years later, they have this gigantic army, they have an air force, munitions, fuel. War is a very, very expensive proposition, and this did not happen without the cooperation and support of the international financiers, the House of Rothschild, the House of Rockefeller, the House of Morgan, the House of Bush. And my question for you is, we know that none of this would have been possible without the financing of these elite financiers. So my question to you is, will the role of these international financial elites who basically bring these situations about to make money and exert control and so on, will that ever become an accepted part of the narrative, or is that going to be relegated to, conspiracy theorists and crazy people who, see conspiracies coming out of the shadows? Thank you.
It's a very important issue, and it's a link between World War I and World War II, as you say. The reparations that Germany had to pay play a huge role in World War II. We go into some detail about this in the Chapter 9, which is much later in the series, you know, because we originally had done the origins of World War II as chapter. The other two chapters Peter referenced were not shown in this 10 hours because we ran out of time and money. But we will put them in the DVD, and they're very good chapters. And it used to be in that chapter. But we moved it to Chapter 9 in the Showtime series because we tied it to the 1990s, the late 90s, mid-90s on, when America had no more enemy in the Soviet Union and was looking for ways to hype up the ante and to keep the military machine going. So the concept of American triumphalism, we went into that in depth, and it was fitting that George Bush, the father, was president because he was a World War II pilot. And we had Tom Brokaw, The Greatest Generation. We had Steve Ambrose. We had Steven Spielberg and Private Ryan. So we had this whole re-celebration of the World War II generation. We went after that because out of that came this desire for war, which George Bush carried to its finale and Mr. Obama, too. So we've fallen in love with the American myth of World War II. And in doing that, we went back into all these corporate. You mentioned these banks, but you don't mention Standard Oil. You don't mention General Motors, Ford, and all the companies that worked, IBM, all the companies that worked with Nazi Germany as sometimes latently through Spain. And we go into that in Chapter 9.
The Prescott-Bush connection is very, very important. Prescott was the father of George H.W. and the grandfather of George W. Bush. And with his Union Banking Corporation, he was representing Nazi interests, as were the Dulleses, as were a lot of very prominent people, not only up till 1938, but American business, as Oliver was saying, was in bed with the Nazis through the early part of the war, after the fighting had started already. And we go into great detail about the various studies that have come out about Ford and the others who were refusing to rearm for the United States, but retooled their manufacturing in Germany to rearm for the Nazis. So this is a very sordid, unknown part of American history that we reveal very, I think, compellingly in Chapter 9 and also in the book.
My name is Josh Tolliver, and I have a question for Mr. Stone. With the majority of your films having to do with, like, political issues and war, is it easier to make a film that has to do with your, like, personality and things you went through? And if so, what can you tell young filmmakers on helping us find what's unique to ourselves and to tell a story to others?
Well, I think you have to live through your time, and sometimes it takes time, you know, to wake up to these things. I certainly didn't wake up. When Daniel Ellsberg was going to jail, I was a confused Vietnam veteran. So, you know, it wasn't until the mid-80s with Reagan that I really started to get going and start to see this thing in another light. Reagan in the Central America, I'm talking about, when I did Salvador. So it was through my own experience. So don't fault yourself if at your age you don't see the whole picture. Believe me, very few of us do. I would say stick to your experience. But be thoughtful and look, please, at alternative news. Always, there's no simple answers. Have a debate. Even on this series, you should go to all the pro-atomic bomb theories, too, to understand what the debate is. I think that only reasonable thing you can do is have a debate with yourself and with people who are intelligent and try to find out more. And that's the best thing colleges and universities can do.
I wonder, with what seems to me overwhelming evidence that people around the world want peace, and now with, not to overstate it, but burgeoning technologies that are connecting people better than ever before, I wonder if any of you see mechanisms that we might build or use to establish or register that sense of people's will around the world, and then how also a mechanism for making that will manifest.
Project Censored here deals with the fact that our media are part of government censorship. in a way, to a considerable extent, keep the public from knowing what they need to know. As I just said, for example, Stimson, who is presented as being more wise, let's say, than some of the other people in the film just now, I'm less enamored than Peter is, as we've argued over the years, of Stimson. But Stimson's response to the Hersey, John Hersey argument, which for the first time really made people aware in words, but in interviews, of the devastation of Hiroshima. And they were afraid that people would see Hiroshima after all, this is in 46, as less legitimate than they had been led to believe. So Stimson, at the instigation of Conant, James Conant, who was then had been in charge of the bomb project, but was president of Harvard during that time and then later, said, you've got to do something to deal with Hersey here, people. And we've got to explain the bomb in a way that will make the killing of 100,000, ultimately 300,000 Nagasaki and Hiroshima together by 1950. This was only 46. But we've got to make it seem legitimate that we slaughtered a couple of 100,000 people here, mostly women and children, men were away at war, old people, and so forth. So they gave a set of reasons. The Stimson article in Harper's, which dominated American thinking about this now for almost half a century, or for many, many years, for a generation, made no mention of the Soviet considerations, the Soviet entry into the war, or that being consideration, whatever, went right through the standard line that is given the lie in this movie now, you know, so much later, and by other people, and convince people that, after all, this great act of terrorism had been necessary and therefore justified. And we were that led the underpinnings now of our being willing to create the arsenal that we have ever since. Now, what's really struck me thinking about Stimson tonight as I watched that was Stimson's article in Harper's was the equivalent of Zero Dark 30. Right now, presenting the legitimation with the help of the instigation of the Pentagon and the CIA, legitimating torture. It's illegal, but it was necessary. It was effective. It was crucial to getting Osama bin Laden. And I'm afraid that that film, I'm hoping very much, it's nominated for an Oscar. I would hate for it to get it. But even if it doesn't get it, being seen by the American people, I think will go very far toward legitimating torture for future administrations. Peter was saying earlier that I think in answer to the questions that came up about documentaries and whatnot, bringing out the history not 40 years later and 50 years later or 10 years later or whenever it's been, but when it can be acted on to affect our policy right now is of crucial importance. Project Censored helps in that, but what's really crucial is for people in the government, like Bradley Manning and Julian Assange, who is not in the government but acting as a publisher here, but for Bradley Manning, what did Bradley Manning do? And why is he facing life imprisonment, which he may very well get, and sitting in a prison cell right now? Because he gave us a picture not 10 years from now and not 2 years from now, but of the torture, the assassination, the aggression, the lies that were going on right now, both under George W. Bush and Obama. And, well, they're doing what they can, of course, to discourage other people from putting us in the know in that way now by confronting him with a life sentence. But I am inspired by his example, and I hope that other Americans will be too. We do need people who will take the personal risk of living up to their oath to the Constitution, which they've all taken, which Bradley Manning is essentially the only person in the armed services to have done.
Let me just add that it was Dan's example that Manning was following.
Well, I would like to think that, but I think he's doing it on his own. Thank you.
I'd like to ask you, Dan, because it's about his question. And how would it have been for you in 1967 if the Pentagon Papers had come out and the internet had been around. What do you think would have happened?
Well, yeah, we were starting on it in 67, it so happened. I gave it in 67. It was essentially finished in early 69. And I gave it to the Senate in late 69. They did not hold hearings ever, in fact, because it discredited the Democrats who were in control of the Congress as much as it did the Republicans. So they never held hearings on it. And then I gave it to the press in 71. And people have asked me, what would I have done now? And the answer is, first of all, I'd still go. I would do, by the way, now what Julian Assange did in terms of giving it not only to the New York Times, but to a number of other newspapers so that the Times itself could not suppress it. The Times knew that what they didn't print, El País, Le Monde, The Guardian would do, and it kept the heat on them to get a lot more. That was very, very astute of Julian at that point. But I would have given it to the press because they have the authority. They have the they can print it great length. People wouldn't read it. But I would not do what the people did who told the Times that the Constitution was being ripped apart, Fourth and Fifth Amendments, by the George W. Bush administration after 2003, that was using the National Security Agency to listen to all of our communications. They told the Thomas Tam and others told the Times that in 2004, before the election, and the Times, at the request of the White House, sat on it, not only after the election, but for another year entirely. Now, I'm surprised that people just waited that long, but I can say right now, in my case, the Times did not tell me, for reasons I've never entirely understood, did not tell me they were going ahead. And I was giving it to Senator Gravel and Senator Mathias and various other people to get it out. But if the Internet had existed, I wouldn't wait a month, 2 months, for the Times to decide to do that finally. I would then put it on the Internet right away.
Dan was facing 115 years in prison.
That would have been life.
Yeah, that would have been life imprisonment for releasing the Pentagon Papers, even though Dan thought it might not even affect the outcome of the war, just with the chance that he could shorten the war, he was willing to risk spending the rest of his life in jail. I think that is an example of the kind of heroism people need to show.
Those were the voices of Daniel Ellsberg, Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, from an event Project Censored sponsored February 2013 at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. We have that available if people are interested, the entire DVD. You can go to projectcensored.org and contact us there if you happen to be interested. But I wanted to say that the things that Daniel Ellsberg hits upon, they really do connect all the way up through to the present about our obligations to the Republic and to the public interest. And of course, Daniel Ellsberg took great risks with the Pentagon Papers and really sharing documents from the federal government about what the government was actually doing in the war in Vietnam. And they really shed a lot of light on what was happening in the war policy. And it was, of course, contradictory to the public narrative and the official narrative. And Ellsberg thought that people had a right to know about that. And back in the early 1970s, you know, the New York Times agreed. And when President Nixon tried to shut that down, the Supreme Court didn't have it. We live in a time now, over 40 years later, where it seems that not only will the New York Times not assist in the leaking of documents and telling people what's going on in the society, but we have a court system that seems to want to punish whistleblowers. The Obama administration, under the guise of hope and change, has persecuted and prosecuted more whistleblowers than any president in history combined. There literally is a war on journalism, and in essence, what we could say is there's really a war on transparency and information. There's a war on the right of the public to know what their government in the United States is doing, and the Obama administration will stop seemingly nowhere. They will continue to go after whether it's John Kiriakou and the former CIA who was outing torture and waterboarding, and instead of the people committing acts of torture going to prison, John Kiriakou is sitting in prison. Thomas Drake at the NSA showing corruption and scandals there. He was intimidated and gone after. Of course, people are very familiar with Chelsea Manning outing the collateral murder video and WikiLeaks and with Julian Assange. And Chelsea Manning is staring down 35 years in prison, and none of the people that are outlined in these documents in the WikiLeaks are being gone after or prosecuted for the crimes they're committing in these illegal imperial wars. Well, the untold history of the United States looks at a long view of America's imperial wars from the early 1900s all the way up to the present. And the thing about the series and book that I think are very useful for the public here is that it's not that historians aren't familiar with many of these facts and these details. It's the general public. And even though we've certainly had Howard Zinn, People's History, Francis Fitzgerald, we've had many historians uncovering the people's history and these vernacular narratives and counter-narratives to American hegemony. But this is arguably one of the most accessible and widespread. This was a Showtime series. It's a best-selling book. It's a place for people to really sit down and have some conversations and take a look at the hope and change, the elixirs peddled in the Obama administration from 2008 and 2012. What's changing? Well, we have far more wars. We have more drone strikes. We have more civilian attacks as a result of this. We have higher budgets for the military. We have more spying, metadata collection. We now know from the Edward Snowden revelations and documents that there's a massive database of information going on here. And people really need to know about that. And that whistleblower, Edward Snowden, connecting back to Daniel Ellsberg, that document dump that Glenn Greenwald is reporting to us, that is a very significant piece of history. That shows that the federal government not only was collecting data and collecting it arguably illegally, but they were lying about doing it. And the director of national intelligence, James Clapper, lied to Congress about this, lied to Congress, and nothing happened. We need accountability, but in order for there to be accountability, there needs to be awareness. And people need to understand what's going on here. Instead of jumping on the bandwagon of shooting the messenger, we need to really support a vibrant and strong, truly free press. Certainly we at Project Censored have been doing that since 1976, and I would like to laud both Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick for this accessible counter-narrative, The Untold History of the United States. They end their book by coming up to the present, Obama managing a wounded empire. And they complete their book thusly: in what would presage a remarkable turnaround if it continues, even Barack Obama began showing faint signs of returning to the transformational figure he had appeared to be during the 2008 campaign, spurred by the Occupy Wall Street movement's success in getting out its message, continued Republican intransigence, economic stagnation, budgetary constraints, and tumbling approval ratings. By late 2011, Obama appeared to be regaining some of his old dynamism. Traces of populism crept into his speeches. He openly embraced ending the Iraq War and cutting defense spending, even though both developments had been forced upon him. Was there a chance that he might be undergoing a Kennedy-esque road to Damascus conversion and realizing how poorly American militarism and imperialism had served the American people and the rest of the world? The prospects looked dim. His Fort Bragg speech and willingness to sign the extremely dangerous 2012 Defense Authorization Bill were not encouraging. Stone and Kuznick continue. What had become apparent was that the real hope for changing the United States, for helping it regain its democratic, egalitarian, and revolutionary soul, lay in U.S. citizens, joining with the rebellious masses everywhere to deploy the lessons of history, their history, the people's history, which is no longer untold, and demand creation of a world that represents the interests of the overwhelming majority, not that of the wealthiest, greediest, and most powerful. Building such a movement is also the only hope to save American democracy from the clutches of an ever-expanding, ever-encroaching national security state. Such tyranny was a threat that America's revolutionary leaders understood very well. When a woman asked Benjamin Franklin in 1787 after the Constitutional Convention, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" Franklin responded with words as timely today as when he uttered them, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Sharing the untold history of the United States getting this information into the hands of the citizens of the United States and the world really helps arm people with the power knowledge gives, to paraphrase James Madison, and also underscores the significance of education, disseminating this kind of information, and continuing the dialogue. The late Pete Seeger once said, participation, that's what's going to save the human race. And at the Project Censored Show here today, we'd like to share this information and invite you into participating in a more democratic and egalitarian future. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. You can find archives at our shows at projectcensored.org. Please keep tabs on us, like the NSA, and like us on Facebook. Thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and we hope you tune in next time. Take care.